Hello again, and welcome to the newsletter from GaiaSpor.org, offering Gnostic intel and Sophianic insight on events and issues of today. The date is September 21st, 2014, and this is issue number one, presented by your friendly homegrown Telestis, John Lash. The title is Constructing Conscience. To begin this spoken part of this newsletter, I'd like to make a comment on the subject of recreating the mysteries or constructing a mystery school network in the world today. You know, as I recall, the first time that anyone proposed that idea to me, well, I can remember it quite vividly. I was standing on the stage at the Marion Foundation in Marion, Massachusetts. It must have been in 1997 or 1998, in October, I believe. So I had been invited to talk at the Marion Foundation, as it was called then. It's now called the Marion Institute, by my friend and colleague of the time, Graham Hancock. I had met Graham in London in May of 1996. And as a consequence of that meeting, Graham later invited me to be co-speaker with him at an event sponsored by the Marion Foundation. So there I was, and I chose to present as my part of the event an introduction to the mysteries. And I represented myself as a spokesperson, someone who was standing there before the audience as evidence that the mysteries had existed and that the mysteries contained a special and unique message for humanity. And it was my intention at that time to introduce that message to those people. Well, it went over rather well. I would say, in fact, that news of the mysteries brought to the Marion Foundation at that time, going on almost maybe 20 years now, 16 at least, produced a kind of wave of euphoria among the people present. And there was a lot of excitement. And during the course of the conversations that followed my presentation, well, someone came up and asked me about the revival or recreating of the mystery schools in our time. Needless to say, I wasn't prepared to undertake anything of the sort at that time, and I made it clear that I didn't really know how to proceed, except for saying that it might be good to drop a few million bucks on me, you know, to get me kickstarted. So at that early date, I hadn't even fully reconstructed the sacred Sophia narrative of the mysteries. I had not delved deeply into the question of correction either. So it took some years before the conditions were provided by life itself and by events in the life of the planetary animal mother that bring me to this moment when I can most definitely make that proposal. Of course, looking back on it, you can see what had to happen. 2020 vision in hindsight, right? So the scenario had to be written, recovered and restored, and the 9-episode Fallen Goddess scenario had to be put before the world. The disclosure of the organic light had to be made. And the account of the destruction of the mysteries and the destruction of indigenous pagan spirituality in Europe had to be given. And all that was done in the ensuing years, right? So by November of 2006, when Nod and His Image came out, the moment had arrived for the world to know about these things. And I still was not ready to found a mystery school at the time, and it never crossed my mind. 6 or 7 years ago. Well, what happens next in this suspenseful adventure of ours? Next comes correction. First, the 3 years of reset, March 2011 to March 2014. And then, immediately coming out of reset into correction, I have the idea of the revival of the mysteries deposited in my mind, as it were, in the form of a terma-like object. You can call it an imaginal object if you like. Hey, that's nice. An icon, a Tibetan yidam, is an imaginal object. Okay, go look up that word, imaginal. And it's not imaginary. Okay? So the imaginal object is here, and the Turton sees it. And what I then do is turn around and hand over to you and to the world at large this imaginal icon. Now you can picture it as a piece or snippet of film. And it's about the size of 2 postage stamps end to end, so that you could actually hold it in your hand, let's say between your fingers. Hold up your right hand with your thumb vertically and your forefinger curved. Imagine that you were just holding that clip of film right in front of your eyes. And what you see on that clip of film is the chemical structure that I indicated in the first newsletter. I am certain, I am totally convinced that it would be inconceivable, premature, and unproductive to have become engaged in the project of founding a mystery school or schools at any moment before this imaginal icon was available. Remember that the planetary animal mother herself is preparing the conditions for the fruiting bodies of the mycelia of Anthropos 11. And the conditions for the sprouting of the new seed of the Anthropos, if you will, the mutated seed, are seen in conditions in the atmosphere which have developed over the last 3 years during reset, which have become evident, become known, studied, which have become noted by many people. And I summarize all of these conditions under the term supersaturation. So with the supersaturation of the atmosphere, conditions are prepared for those of us in planetary tantra to practice match and merge, which is the Gayan tantric equivalent to the generation and completion meditation of Dzogchen. The way to the first step in reviving the mysteries, materially speaking, is to practice this exercise of meditation upon the imaginal icon, which is the chemical structure of DNA. And so I said before, but let me clarify it one more time, that regardless of where these schools may appear materially, and regardless of the actual physical and architectural structure of the buildings and the units, the teaching rooms, the study rooms, and the residential units, regardless of all that, this single imaginal icon is the yidam for producing those places, for producing those temples and sanctuaries of learning. And so, suppose that some people in Costa Rica come together with the skills and the resources and they create a mystery school, or some people in Iceland, or some people in Wales, or Spain, or the Ukraine, or some of the in the Balkan countries. No matter what the exact and particular physical conditions of the construction are, all the constructions are based on that template icon. Do you understand? And so even if you just consider your home to be a mystery school sanctuary, then I propose to you that you would have on the wall of your home, beautifully drawn by hand, beautifully framed, that you would have that icon illustrated, so that every time you set your eyes on it, you have a double vision. You know that the place where you are, physically, materially, architecturally, is the manifestation in the tonal of this icon. But at the same time, the icon remains in the supernatural as a seeding agency. Get that picture. It's really important. I'm trying to explain it with extreme care because much depends on holding this meditation and pursuing this exercise of match and merge in order to bring forth the Gaian Mysteria in our time. Now, throughout this talk, I'd be most delighted if you would give consideration to something that I consider throughout each day now, namely the conditions of the current moment regarding the possibility to found a mystery school, even just a single one, not to mention a network. Well, needless to say, the conditions appear, in some respects, to be pretty bad. But I follow the rule, and we'll see if it proves to be true or not, that the best chances for the anthropos humans, to manifest their true potential and their divine endowment of Thelete and Sophia comes at the worst possible moment in the nightmare of history. So always bear in mind that war is always a production of greed of some kind or another. And what drives the world toward war is greed or envy, not just greed to have more, but it's the greed of the spoilers, the ones who want everything and don't want anyone else who's not in their camp or clan or tribe to have anything at all. So that is the destructive power of envy. It totally denies peaceful coexistence and sharing of the abundance and beauty of life. But bear in mind as well that what enables envy, which works against human nature, what allows envy to operate is a lie composed and imposed by those who profit from suffering, destruction, murder, and mayhem. And so at this moment, the lie that is driving or facilitating the agenda of envy is coming to be exposed. And so it is at that very moment of its exposure that it also comes to be defeated. Now remember that in the G&E briefings I spoke of the countermanding truth. I said that it wasn't enough just to expose the orchestrations of social evil on this planet. It's also necessary to defeat them and overcome them. And to that end, something more than exposure, finger-pointing, and blaming must come into play, right? So there must be a countermanding truth that stands against the lie and overwhelms and overcomes it, and therefore overcomes the agenda of the envious, the spoilers. I suggest that the salient countermanding truth at this moment in human history is mutual aid. This is an idea, a theme, a proposal, if you will, a proposition about human nature that initially came out of Russia in the 19th century. And it was proposed by the Russian naturalist and anarchist, Peter Kropotkin. So mutual aid has to be demonstrated, of course, in many and various ways. And who knows, one of these ways, perhaps the preeminent way, to demonstrate the spirit of mutual aid on this planet would be to manifest the Gaian Mysteria by a process of sharing resources, consolidation of resources, funds, finances, and a consolidation of skills and facilitation. That's what it would take to produce a global network of temples and teaching sites. Now, even though I wasn't ready to talk like I'm talking now, when someone posed me the question about reviving the mysteries way back when at the Marian Foundation, many things in the lives of many people have been developing in the ensuing years that have been preparing some of you who hear my words to join and participate in this great undertaking. In fact, just today I received a message from one GNE member, a loyal GNE member, Holly, who was in fact an original member of the Fab Five, or Fab Five, I guess it is. And I've reproduced her letter here. I'm not going to read through it all, but it raises a couple of points. And for a couple of points I might address. Also, it shows that here is someone speaking about 1995, going back to 1995 in her life, you know, just a couple of years before I was at the Marian Foundation, and talking about dreaming the idea of a network of temples across the world, and feeling that it was a part of her destiny to do that. And I am absolutely certain that she is not the only one who has felt that way over the last 15 or 20 years, or perhaps even longer. And those of you who have, now have a focus. You now have a place to bring your intention, and you have a growing gathering of people around the world who share that intention. And so this is how the idea now emerges. Holly talks about having to deal with the insanity and nonsense of the world, and at the same time holding this intention in a resolute and unfaltering way. She also talks about something of a coincidence, you might say, an uncanny thing, that in 2009, which is the year that I released Planetary Tantra to the world, in January of 2009, she was actually not far from where I am right now. She was in a nearby village in Andalusia, and there were a group of people there who were endeavoring to create a sanctuary for people who wanted to move to a different way of living, biochemically through connection to the land, through entheogenic nutrition, herbs, and etc. And as she explains, the group disbanded because they weren't clear enough on their motive and they didn't know the vision story as she knows it now and lives it. And they had personal agendas and dramas, and haven't you heard this story before? Well, of course, there may have been attempts, unconscious, semi-conscious, or otherwise, to draw together a community of people for the purpose of creating a mystery school over the last two or three decades. They could not possibly succeed if two things were lacking. If they didn't have the Sophianic narrative, the vision story of the mysteries, to guide them and unify them and give them transpersonal purpose. And secondly, if they didn't have the imaginal icon for the construction of the place, the site, the building, the temple. Now, both of those elements are provided. So how wonderful is that? Just like to point out as a brief comment on this wonderful email that it was written in Iceland. I've said before, you know, I started saying it during reset, the wave breaks from the north. The Fortunate Isles are those places upon the earth where people gather with the common spirit of mutual aid. The Fortunate Isles is a term in Gaian navigation jargon for the first islands of the new humanity that Sophia sees in her imagination. And she does not merely see these islands in a dreaming without substance. She sees these islands in a material expression of her own dreaming. And some of the Fortunate Isles will first appear through the northern mists and in the northern climes, because the wave breaks from the north. But then Fortunate Isles will appear simultaneously in the south, for instance, in the southernmost part of continental Europe, which is Andalusia, perhaps in the Greek islands, in Croatia, or in the Ukraine, or in Canada, or in Florida, simultaneously. And with the appearance of these groups of people who are commonly motivated in the spirit of mutual aid and who are willing to gather all of their personal resources and commit them to creating the Mystery School Network, among them you will also find in many cases the poets and the shamans and the storytellers of the tribe, if you will, who revive the indigenous languages and the epics and the folk memory. And this is an important theme I will pick up in a forthcoming newsletter, the theme of phylogenetic memory and the return of folk memory during the winter of 2014 and 2015. This is a massive event in the second attention of the Aeon Sophia, and it can be tracked and timed. So I'll talk about that exciting development soon. You might recall that I sent out a letter to the GNE crew at the end of July, in which I mentioned some studies of the Icelandic Eddas. And among those studies, you find the word anda, which means a wave or pulsation. Now, this is a term that comes out of the ancient Icelandic language, and yet today this term could be revived and it could be used in the Icelandic translation of the fallen goddess scenario to describe the plume or jet of plasma of organic light produced by Sophia's plunge. That also was anda. And this is just one example of many instances that I see now concerning the translation of the fallen goddess scenario into European languages, such as Dutch, German, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian. And as it is translated into those languages, those who translate it, Lithuanian, the translation into Lithuanian is currently underway. And as the FGS is translated into these languages, the ancient folk memories will be drawn like particles of metal to a magnet. They will be drawn out of the endopsyche, and they will be restored through the power of that mythic narrative. Now, there have been some groping attempts in this direction of the restoration and resurgence of phylogenetic memory. You could consider, perhaps, that the Ringing Cedars books, the Anastasia series, based in Russia, was motivated or inspired in that way, perhaps. I'm not sure. I would consider it, if so, a botched attempt or perhaps even a fraud. But take a look at this remarkable phenomenon called the Bach Saga, and you will find that there are, this is a sterling example of the recall or return of folk memory, and with it, the wisdom of the folk. And as far as I know, I haven't studied the Bach Saga in depth, but it appears to have some parallels even with Kala Tantra. That would have to do with the use of human secretions, sexual secretions, for sacred purposes. This is a practice in Kala Tantra, and from my cursory investigation, it also appears to have been a practice described in the Bach Saga, if you want to listen to the interview with Michael Merle on Red Ice that might be a good introduction to this topic. So while this is happening, simultaneously, we're facing the endgame of the spoilers, the agents of envy, with the core group of those people being the Zads, the Zadokite Talmudic Jews who founded the International Banking Mafia. And the International Banking Mafia has to go down for correction to be manifest on the social scale, as you know. I mean, I think that would be obvious to any sane person at this point in the discourse. Now, you must always bear in mind, as you consider the endgame of the spoilers and the executive branch, if you will, of social evil on this planet, you must always consider that they are allied with supernatural, extra-human, and non-human forces. And these non-human forces are now operating at high pitch through the lie, which facilitates the agenda of envy. But with the correction of the Aeon Sophia, these supernatural forces, the Archons, come to be exposed and defeated, quote, at the consummation of their works, end quote. And what are their works? Well, they are primarily the deceit and fear-mongering, that is, the deceit and fear-mongering that rolls on and roars on in your ears and in your mind day by day due to input from the Zionist-controlled media on this planet. Now, you see in the text that I provided a few lines from the Apocryphon of John referring to the Archons. These lines, among others that might be cited in the Coptic material, make it clear that the Archons feed on deception, apate, and that they are intent, if you will, insofar as beings without intention can be intent, on poisoning the human mind and even poisoning the human body, and that the hatred and deception are tools which they use in the commitment of evil. And one of the Greek words that you find for evil in the Coptic writings is poneria, poneros. And some of you may know of poneriology and political poneriology, which is a study of the devices and deceptions of social evil. A very profound study, as I understand. I haven't had a chance to look at the works of this particular scholar who founded political poneriology, but I've glimpsed some of it, and I understand that it is a penetrating and, in some respects, Gnostic diagnosis of evil on the social and psychological levels. So it's really worth learning about, perhaps, but I also have the sense that this exposé, as dense, as intense as it might be, is not providing solution. So it's probably really good intel, but it's all about the problem. And as you know, the time has come when we can't spend, no one can afford to spend too much more time on the problem. So every 1 hour you spend on investigating the problem, I suggest that you spend 5 on the solution. So what I'm saying, as we all stand on the threshold of the winter of 2014-2015, is that the consummation of this social evil, poneros, poneria, actually brings the anthropine animal to its finest moment. Now is that moment. But is it also the moment to propose and initiate creating a network of mystery schools? Well, it appears to be the same moment. So, and that makes sense to me, because according to the Gnostic intel, the Zads, Zadokite Jews, are proxies of the Archons, and others who participate in agendas of social evil are proxies of the proxies of the archons, and so on it goes. You could say that the illusion of authority on this planet consists of nothing but one set of proxies stacked against another, like dominoes. And those executors of evil have the advantage of the supernatural factor that favors deceit, confusion, fear-mongering, and demoralization. They have a huge advantage. And so the war effort in which you may now be engaged carries a twofold challenge. First, to identify and face the interspecies predators, that is to say, the spoilers who profit and dominate in society by deceiving and suppressing others. And second, to introduce the supernatural factor that works for the benefit of goodness, honesty, and mutual aid. And what is that supernatural factor? Well, precisely, the counter magic that can be taught and developed and practiced through the Mystery School Network. So I say, I rest my case. I say, yes, indeed, the very worst moment in human history is also the moment for humanity to show its best and to recapture and recreate the mysteries. The template for that, architecturally speaking, is the D-lysine-based chiral DNA-PNA duplex. Why? I don't know exactly why that is the one, but I am certain it is. And the reasons why, I am certain, are due to be revealed sooner rather than later. So I'm going to shift now at this point, little at the half-hour mark of this talk, to some of the gruesome reality of the moment. So brace yourself, my friends, because I'm going to go in to a bit of geopolitical analysis, as I may occasionally do from time to time in these Diaspora newsletters. So, as I say, brace yourself and be prepared to hear something about the Jews. I said in previous notes of the previous newsletter that I wasn't going to be Jew-bashing, and I'm not. So I'm not Jew-bashing here. I'm presenting a history lesson in which Jews, or namely Bolshevik Jews, figure as central actors. Now, remember that envy needs the lie to operate and accomplish its aims. For instance, look at the current world situation. Where do you see lies through which envy is operating? Well, take the lie that there is a war in Gaza. That's a lie. There's no war there. Take the lie that there's a war in the Ukraine, in Russia, and that Russia is invading Ukraine. That's a lie. So you can be sure that where you see a lie being promulgated through the Zionist-controlled media, that behind that lie, certain predictable executive forces can be identified, okay? And I'd like to point out that the elements of the lie, the current lie about what's happening in Ukraine, have been constructed in a very lazy and slipshod fashion. Obviously, the people using this lie are without talent and without creative capacity of any kind. So they are merely constructing the current lie about what's happening in Ukraine from a former scenario which involves events that also happened in the Ukraine. Namely, they are drawing upon the so-called Nazi Holocaust narrative lie to construct a completely fraudulent and erroneous scenario of what is happening in Ukraine today. Someone is constructing this. And they're doing it in such a way that it's like the reworking of a script of a bad movie. There was a really bad movie some years ago, and now this bad movie has been reworked. The script and the characters and the plot themes have been recaptured and made into an even worse movie. And so Something that you find in the script of this movie is the use of the word vermin to refer to a population of people. So the Ukraine or the Kiev regime leader, Poroshenko, calls the Eastern Ukrainian Russians vermin. Now, you might compare this statement to the narrative of a notorious film called The Eternal Jew. I've linked it here. And this is a, quote, Nazi propaganda film, unquote, of 1940, in which you find such language as the statement that Jews are, quote, a plague that threatens the health of the Aryan peoples, unquote. Now, remember, I'm not Jew bashing in these newsletter talks. I'm just giving a history lesson here in which the Jews figure largely as agents of certain historical events. So consider it with detachment and dispassion. If you want to, you can substitute the word Filipino for Jews, and you could run the narrative in your mind as if it were the Filipinos who did all these things, okay? History is repeating itself in the Ukraine right now as if the characters and themes and episodes of certain historical events that were conceived and directed by the Jewish Bolsheviks were being replayed. And the theme of the script is the genocidal agenda. So, if you would dare to take a look at this clip from The Truth Seeker, which is an RT series, which seems to have been deleted or suppressed recently. If you want to look at The Truth Seeker, you'll see that it refers, the presenter of The Truth Seeker refers to Hitler's use of the word vermin, inciting Poroshenko's campaign to exterminate the Eastern Ukrainians. The presenter cites Hitler on the Jews. Stock. This is a stock gimmick, right? He says, quote, Hitler gave the same reason, calling them vermin, for ethnically cleansing his country, end quote. Well, yes, he did. In fact, Hitler spoke of not the entire Jewish population of Germany, but certain elements dominated by the Jews in the media, in the courts of law, in the theater and entertainment, the film industry, in banking sectors. Hitler did use the word parasite and vermin for those factions of German society at the time. Sure, he did, of course, it's there on record. But how did he proceed once he had designated certain Jews in German society as vermin? Did Hitler do to the Jews in Germany of the 1930s or even the 1940s, in Germany and Poland, anything like what the U.S.-backed Kiev regime is currently doing to civilian Russians in East Ukraine? I don't think so. Nope. Far from it. So, if you have the courage to sit through this Truth Seeker clip, you'll see that it once again closes at the end with a standard remark, a standard anti-Nazi remark, about the victims of World War II who died heroically fighting the Nazis. But wait a minute. The Nazis were not just fighting the Russian armies because they wanted to conquer Russia. They were fighting the Russian armies led by Judeo-Bolshevik ideologues who wanted to impose communism on Europe. This is the facts of history. And the whole thing was funded on both sides by Zionist bankers. But Hitler was not funded by Zionist bankers, even though many claims have been made to that effect. In my view, the evidence is not there for that case. So, the Nazis are slandered in this Truth Seeker piece with the claim that Hitler was hell-bent on world domination, but in reality, the German army under Hitler was attempting to protect Germany and all of Europe from the Jewish Bolshevik communist regime, which is comparable to the one that is now installed as a U.S. puppet government in Kiev. So there you have it. The old script has been jumbled and grotesquely twisted around only to be replayed. But you know, the Truth Seeker clip also warns about the destruction of the wheat fields in Ukraine, with the possibility that in the winter of 2014-15, untold thousands of people in Ukraine will starve. Does that remind you of anything? Well, go and investigate the Holodomor. You'll find there are some valuable and informative documentaries on that subject on YouTube. It refers to, Holodomor refers to the Holocaust by starvation, the genocide by starvation, which took the lives of 7 to 10 million Ukrainians in the winter of 32 and 33. Are we due to see this event repeated? Well, if someone doesn't stop it, the likelihood that it will repeat is extremely high. And so Truth Seeker reports on the burning of the wheat fields and the intimidation of farmers who try to go out and do their job so that people will have grain to eat through the winter. So what's really remarkable to me, one thing, my final note on this particular topic, what's really remarkable is that the handlers and the schemers who set up the Kiev government as a puppet government of the United States, which in turn is a proxy of Zionist Jews, were clever enough to include right-wing Ukrainian Nazis along with the Jews who are at the head of the Kiev regime. I mean, it's like a brilliant feat of cognitive dissonance. When you look at the Kiev regime, you see Nazis and Jews apparently standing shoulder to shoulder and intent upon the genocide of the Eastern Ukrainian Russians. And so it's like a double cover. First of all, no one is allowed to talk much about the Ukrainian Holocaust, Holodomor, because it might shift sympathy and compassion away from the Jewish Holocaust. And in addition to that, it was Jewish Bolsheviks who orchestrated the Ukrainian Holocaust, you see? So here you have a Jewish leadership of the Kiev regime, which can now be involve itself in, quote, Nazi-like activities of genocide against the East Ukrainians, and the blame in the eyes of the world goes back to the Nazis, who were never to blame in the first place for any of these genocidal activities. Although if you want to understand the genocide that was committed by certain Nazis during the Second World War, well, that is something that needs to be investigated as well. And I've included a passage in the written part of this newsletter, The Courage for Truth, which treats that subject, but I'm just going to gloss over that because I don't want to get bogged down in it too much. I'll just run over it very quickly, the points that you'll see in the written text, where I say, in deconstructing and defeating the Holocaust lie, two facts, among others, are essential at the outset. The first is to know that the final solution was originally proposed by a Jewish anti-white fanatic, Theodor Kaufmann, and the final solution was intended for the German people. And I can assure you, my friends, that that final solution proposed in this book of 1941, Germany Must Perish, is well underway at this time. And it is on track and on time, with the ultimate goal of the complete destruction of the Germanic Teutonic Aryan people and the consignment to oblivion of their culture and their way of life. Second essential point is that extermination of Jews by gassing was not on Hitler's agenda. There is simply no evidence that it was, and that exercise in mass murder has been proven to have been physically impossible on the scale claimed. So, nevertheless, outright murder of Jews was committed on a large scale by Himmler, without Hitler's knowledge and against his orders. And this was called Operation Reinhardt. So if you wish to inform yourself of that, go ahead. The notes here refer to an amazing talk by David Irving about Himmler, in which he goes in detail into the Reinhardt, Operation Reinhardt, and how it was conducted. And he shows very clearly, Irving, who is, as you know, a pro-Hitler scholar, shows very clearly that, yes, Jews were murdered under Himmler's command, but they were not gassed. They were shot and buried in pits. They were not gassed and cremated. And so he goes into great detail about this. In fact, his grasp of the granular detail of the historical events of that time is absolutely astounding. And I include here, the recording of Himmler's blood-chilling talk at Poznan in Poland, in which he declares the program to exterminate all Jews. But bear in mind, that is not evidence for the truth of the Jewish Holocaust legend. It is simply proof that there was one individual among the higher echelon of the military of the Nazi Party who wished to see that in extermination. But the extermination program itself was not on Hitler's agenda. And Irving even claims that Hitler intervened in order to stop Himmler from carrying out Operation Reinhardt. So anyway, if that's something that you have not heard about yet, and you want to take a stand to challenge the conventional Holocaust legend, then you should definitely know about that going in, because it is important that those who challenge the Holocaust legend do not come across as if that challenge permits a total whitewash of certain individuals and certain factions in the German army and in the Nazi regime, in the regime of the Third Reich. It certainly does not permit or legitimate a total whitewash. We have to look at all the facts. And this business of Operation Reinhardt and Himmler's Poznan speech are part of the record of facts, for those of you who dare to look into these things, as your conscience may impel you to do. So, on that point, I would like to get to the main instruction of this newsletter, which concerns the matter of conscience. Now, I've listed here some quotations. First, from the Zen master, Hui Hai, cited in the Zen teaching of Hui Hai, translated by John Blofeld. You may recall that I cited this Q&A between a monk and the Chan master at the end of the GNE. Finally, you will see, if you wish to examine the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2, verse 19, an escape clause. I call it an escape clause. We'll see what I mean by that in a moment. Finally, or additionally, there is the poem Brahma by Ralph Waldo Emerson, which paraphrases that passage from the Bhagavad Gita. And by the way, if you'd like to read about how Buddhism and Asian pacifism came to the West, then you might look at this book, How the Swans Came to the Lake by Rick Fields. And it's available in PDF on the internet. I've put the link there. Finally, a quotation from A Scene in Parzival. Now, all of these citations refer to the question of suffering, and they lead to the construction of conscience. So to proceed in that direction, which is the main aim of this talk, I'd like to make it perfectly clear what the question of suffering is. Well, to that end, let's go back to the quotation from the Zen teaching of Weihai that I cited at the end of the GNE. Once somebody inquired to the master, suppose a man is sitting in a boat and the keel cuts to death a shellfish. Is the man guilty, or should the boat be blamed? The master replied, man and boat had no mind to kill the shellfish, and the only person to blame is you. When a tearing wind snaps off a branch which falls and kills somebody, there is no murder and no murdered. In all the world, there is no place living beings do not have to suffer. End quote. Now, as I said when I cited that originally, I would advise a paraphrase, because in fact this was an encounter that happened in a moment in the 10th or 11th century, and unless you were there, you don't really know how it came down. And for our purposes here, it would be wise to paraphrase, that is to say, to play with the script a little bit. So I suggested that the last sentence should be, in all the world, there is no place where human animals can escape the question of suffering. So, the incident brought to the master by the student raises the question. It gives the occasion to consider the question of suffering. And no matter what you may make of this exchange, whether you want to stick rigorously and literally to the given translation of Blofeld, or whether you want to play with it a little to get a little more latitude and to extract a meaning from it, no matter which way you go, it is clear that the exchange poses a difference between something that happens and causes suffering, and in this case death, the death of the shellfish, or the death of someone killed by a branch that falls from a tree, and other forms of harm and death, which are the result of deliberate action. So the master rightly says, if the wind breaks off a branch of a tree, falls on someone and kills them, you can't say that the tree is the murderer and the person has been murdered, because that is not murder. So clearly there is harm that may occasion death occurring constantly in the human world that cannot be attributed to a human agency. But there are other cases when it can be attributed to a human agency. And clearly, and that's what we call blaming. That's what we call assigning blame. And so the Zen master is obviously sensitive to that point, because he says, man in boat had no mind to kill the shellfish, which is factually true, and the only person to be blamed is you. Why is he saying that to the inquiring student? Because he's showing the student that the question of blame is in the mind of the student, and therefore the person to be blamed is the person who blames. You see? So that is a very astute Zen insight. So assigning blame is an issue that comes up when you put yourself before the question of suffering. Why? Because when you look soberly at the question of suffering, you see that there are two kinds of suffering in the world. That which just happens in the course of life, by accident, through the events of the natural world, and that which is deliberate to human agencies with the intention to harm or kill others. So when you put yourself before the question of suffering, you bring that distinction. This is the paramount prerequisite. So I would say now, as we're looking deeply into this question, once again, as we return to this question, over and over again, I would say to you that the question of suffering is about the purpose of suffering. Well, what is the purpose of suffering? Here's one answer for you. The purpose of suffering is to present an occasion to construct conscience. Now, if you consider that proposition in the light of what I just said, then you must apply that distinction that I noted. Can you see that? In other words, the proposition that the purpose of suffering, of human suffering on this planet, is to provide an occasion to construct conscience, refers or applies to that suffering which is due to human agency exclusively. Well, what about the other kind of suffering that is not due to deliberate intent to harm, to dominate, to suppress, to spoil, or to kill? What about all the other suffering that human beings can experience that is not due to evil human intent? Well, that's an occasion for compassion. So compassion and conscience come up immediately in the syntax when you contemplate the question of suffering. Compassion is the attitude that you cultivate toward all that suffering which may befall you or other people, which is not intentionally brought upon human beings by other human beings. You face that with compassion, or you may face it with indifference or dispassion or detachment, depending on your character. But I'd say it's fair to say that that's where compassion applies. Now, if you apply compassion to that kind of suffering, who is to say that you wouldn't apply compassion to the other kind of suffering as well? But you don't. You don't. Because the compassion for the victims of deliberate human harm makes you complicit in the victim-perpetrator syndrome. That's a very hard truth. Think of the Palestinians when you look over that one in your mind. But on the other hand, the part of the proposition that refers to harm due to human intent does not require compassion. Because if you apply compassion to those who deliberately harm others, all you're going to do is further their agenda. So compassion and love do not work on people who intentionally harm others. They do not work on perpetrators. The question of evil perpetrated by human beings upon other human beings must be faced with conscience. But how can you face it with conscience if you don't have a conscience in the first place? Now, it's my contention that this is the human problem. It has been widely assumed that human animals have something called conscience, and that they may or may not act on that conscience. But I ask you to consider this, my friends. Are there not innumerable instances in human history and today where human individuals and communities and groups of individuals had the opportunity to act on their conscience and they didn't? Are there not innumerable examples of that? If you agree, then I'm going to ask you this. Given that there are so many examples, Are you going to conclude? What are you going to conclude? Are you going to conclude that they had conscience, but they did not act on it? It's like saying, I have money in my pocket, and I go to the fair, but I don't go on any rides, and I don't spend any money. But I had it in my pocket. Or are you going to say, I didn't go on any rides, and I didn't buy any candy at the fair because I don't have any money? I submit to you that the enlightened view of conscience in the human animal assumes that conscience is not given in a predetermined manner and has to be constructed. And only once it is constructed consciously, knowingly, can the human animal who has constructed it act upon their conscience. This is my premise. And in the next 15 minutes of this newsletter, I'll try to elaborate that premise as clearly as I can. Now, as I proceed with this rather challenging exposition, I'm including a query that came in, an email on the 11th of September from a G&E member regarding Sophia. I've included it in the written material. The query takes the form of a simple question. Could you address why Sophia can only, in your own words, achieve correction with a measure of human participation? Quote, she needs our witnessing and our interaction in order to correct that experiment. Quote, I guess the whole thing is a quote from me. And indeed, I did say so numerous times, during the G&E. For her correction to succeed, the Aeon Sophia needs a measure of human participation. And she cannot fully succeed without our witnessing and our interaction. And so the query continues. So far, I haven't been able to answer that question for myself. Namely, well, why does she need that? Well, it's remarkable that this question comes up. And it's wonderful for me to be able to include it in this current exposition about conscience. In my elaboration of the Fallen Goddess scenario, up to 4.0 and counting, I realized when I got this email that I have not yet explained something that is essential about the divine experiment of the Aeon Sophia with the Anthropos on this planet. Namely, the success of the experiment on her terms, that is to say, on aeonic terms, on divine terms, depends upon what the anthropine species does in that part of the experiment over which the wisdom goddess has no determination at all. She leaves a part of the experiment completely open, unwritten, and undetermined, and contributes nothing whatsoever even to setting up that part of the experiment. In other words, although she sets up the experiment for us on this planet on a massive scale, there is one area where she does not in any respect prepare the conditions for the experiment. She leaves it to the Anthropos itself to construct particular conditions over which she completely removes her influence, over which conditions in which she exerts no influence whatsoever. And it is what the human animal does in those conditions which, in her view, determine not only the success of the experiment, but the degree to which humanity can participate in her correction. That omission represents itself in the factor of social conscience, conscience in the social order. In fact, one of the first things that I realized, much to my amazement, when I began to converse with the Aeon Sophia on Infinity Ridge, was that social order is not in her syntax. She has no syntax for social order. Now, this is a staggering realization when you stand in front of it. When you look at the dreaming of the material world that we call the biosphere, when you look at all the realms of nature, from the aquatic realm to the sky, to the birds, to the insects, to the countless species, to the plants, when you look at the order and design of all of that, what do you have? You have the evidence, the overwhelming and massive evidence that she designs order everywhere, that natural order and symbiosis are the very signature of her presence, the signature of her dreaming. But when it comes to the human social order, there is no such detectable signature, is there? That is because she intentionally leaves that dreaming out of her world picture, because she counts on the Anthropos itself to construct the design and order of its society. When you see other animals who have society, like sea lions or gulls or June beetles or vultures, you see that they have society, that they have a social order. Gary Snyder pointed out that all the kingdoms of nature, the extra-human, non-human kingdoms, exhibit social order, but their social order is predetermined in her dreaming. She gives them their social order through a set of instinctual blueprints that they follow without any consideration or need for construction. But she does not do anything like that. She deliberately and totally excludes her ordering power from the realm of human society and leaves it entirely to us. And in order for human animals to construct a human society that is sustainable, they need a number of identifiable factors. That would be an interesting discussion in itself. One of those factors is an agreement upon making agreements. In Gaian ethics, you encounter the statement that there are no God-given rights, there are no goddess-given rights to human animals. There are only agreements in the human community. So let's agree that there are no goddess-given rights, but only agreements, because she left that part of the experiment entirely to our devices. That would be a step in the construction of a social order. But at the core of the construction of the human social order is the construction of conscience that must take place in each individual. I can't say in the conscience of each individual, because you don't have a conscience in the first place. In the freedom of each individual mind, the construction of conscience is the first step in the construction of a social order. And so each and every one of us would have to go through some kind of exercise in constructing conscience. And I'm going to propose to you how that would be done. It might be done by a kind of catechism. Now, you know what a catechism is. It's a sequence of questions and answers presented in a formulaic statements. And these statements are used for the purpose of inculcating a religious doctrine. So, most famously, there is the Catechism of the Catholic Faith, which the Catholics use to brainwash young children by shaming them or forcing them into giving the prescribed answers. Now, there are prescribed answers in the Catechism of Conscience that I'm going to propose to you as well. But they are not prescribed by John Lash so that you can join a cult or belong to some Gaian religious order. They are prescribed for the existential purpose of presenting syntax for you to know what it means to have a conscience. Okay? So here is roughly how the catechism would go. I would say to you, I am the priest of conscience providing or presiding on this exchange, and I would say to you, now you stand before the question of suffering. In the first place, do you accept to face it or not? If you want to face it, you say yes. If you don't want to face the question of suffering, you can use the opt-out clause in the Bhagavad Gita. If any man thinks he slays, or if another thinks he is slain, neither knows the ways of truth. The internal in man cannot kill. The eternal in man cannot die. Do you believe that? If you believe that, then there is your escape clause. You can say, I plead Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, verse 19, and you split. However, if you choose to stand in naked honesty and sobriety before the question of suffering, well, then the catechism continues, and I ask you, do you renounce all excuses for suffering that could be used to refer to some transcendental or superhuman agency who brings suffering into the world for its own mysterious purposes? The answer is, yes, I exclude that. Do you agree not to cite theodicy, and that is to apologize for God in some way to get around the question of suffering? Yes, you agree. Do you agree that there is no karma and no karmic consequences? Yes, you agree. Do you agree that there are no moral consequences of any action? There is only a moral premise to the action. Yes, you agree. Do you agree that guilt is not enough in facing the direct or deliberate perpetration of suffering? That is to say, assigning blame or assigning guilt is not enough. You agree. Finally, do you agree to forego the question of forgiveness as a way to make yourself comfortable with the burden of suffering in the world? The formulaic answer is yes. I agree to forego forgiveness. And finally, do you agree in facing the question of suffering to forego and dismiss the idea of karmic compensation? According to this idea, some inexplicable law of karma operating in the cosmos ensures that good deeds will be rewarded and bad deeds will be punished. Do you agree to entirely forego and dismiss this notion of karmic compensation? The answer is yes, I agree to forego and dismiss karmic compensation. So that's a lot of elimination and stripping down in the first step of the catechism. Can you see that? Finally, having made those matters clear, we come to the second step. Second step involves a question. Do you agree to hold to the clear and vivid distinction between two kinds of suffering? That which is deliberately caused by human animals, harming others, and that which happens in ways not due to human agency. Yes, I agree to hold to that distinction as an existential fact. That is how you would answer in this little catechism I'm proposing. And get me on this, get me straight and clear. Every single person would have to go through this catechism point by point aloud with another human individual as a kind of exercise. And the answers would be the same for all of us. Why? Because the challenge given to us by the Aeon Sophia to construct social order upon the foundation of individual conscience requires this construction. And it requires it to be done openly, verbally, honestly, nakedly, and in the humility of seeing that it is absolutely the same for everyone. You know, there is very little equality in the human world. There is inequality in the social order, and human beings are not born equal. They are born with very different looks, very different intelligence, very different talents. But if there is any one thing that can be considered as the equalizer, constellation of the scales, Libra, right? One thing that puts us all on an equal basis, then it is the catechism for the construction of conscience. So let's proceed a little bit further. You agree that we can ascertain that some harm doing is due to human agencies, even though we may not be able to identify specifically who those agencies are. Look at the harm that is being done to the people of Eastern Ukraine today. Look at the harm that is being done to the population of Syria, the citizens. Look at the harm that is being done to the people in Gaza. It is being deliberately done through the plans, due to the planning and execution of other human beings. But it is not always possible to know or identify exactly who those human agents are. Do you agree? Yes, you agree. So, you agree to see and admit deliberate harm when it happens. Yes, I agree to see and admit deliberate harm when it happens. And let me remind you all, assuming that you have come this far with me in the exercise of the catechism, that in the initial stage of the catechism, you agreed. This is really, really important. You agreed to forego any theodicy. Theodicy means making apologies for God. Do you know that term, theodicy? An apologist. There are no apologies allowed in the construction of conscience. Do you get that? Okay, so now, finally, in the closing minutes of this talk, here is the third stage of constructing conscience. Given your consent, demonstrated by the preceding steps of the catechism, you now stand before the question of suffering as a responsible human being. Do you accept that you are responsible for all the suffering committed by human animals on other human animals, even if you yourself are not the agent, the one who commits it? Can you accept such a responsibility? If you can, then you are ready to go from the theoretical or preparatory stage of constructing conscience to the application of that conscience. Therefore, how do you apply a conscience? Well, once you know that you have one, you apply it in a particular manner. How do you know that you have a conscience? You know that when you can say to another human being, face to face and eye to eye, I accept responsibility to handle the harm and evil done by human animals, even if I myself am not the animal who committed that harm and that evil. If there is a factor of compassion in the construction of conscience, then this is where you find it. You see that? It doesn't mean that you bond with the victims, but it means that you take responsibility for the perpetrators as if you were one yourself, as if you were one of them yourself. But they obviously do not take responsibility for themselves. So those who are committing the genocide in Ukraine, in Syria, in Gaza, and countless other places across this planet are not accountable. They do not take responsibility for themselves. Therefore, the Catechism now proposes the challenge of conscience, which is, are you willing to take responsibility for doing something about those who deliberately cause harm and death to others. Yes or no? And if you say yes, then comes the next question. Are you willing to go to the extent of using force and the violent exertion of force in order to handle those who commit deliberate evil? Yes or no? Now, there's a division that arises in the catechism at this point. If you answer no to that last question, then the catechism comes up with another question for you. Are you willing to support those people who are willing to use violence and the exertion of violent force against those who deliberately harm others? If you are not, then you are required at this point in the catechism to excuse yourself, because you are in effect admitting that you would like to have a conscience, but not only do you not want to act on it, but you don't want to support anyone else who might act on theirs. So even though you may have gotten this far in the catechism, you are deselected on the basis of your response. Now, the final steps of this exercise. Then if you agree to take responsibility for facing the evil deliberately committed by certain human beings, and for facing those human animals yourself, in whatever situation it may be possible to do so, if you say yes to all that, then the final question is, are you ready, willing, and able to place yourself in the ranks of a warrior class? You remember that I came at the end of the GNE to the conclusion, and it really was a conclusion I reached spontaneously at that moment, that what the world needs to solve the terrific, catastrophic horror of the current historical moment is a warrior class. I find the inspiration for this warrior class coming uniquely from Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal, especially as it relates to the question of guarding the Grail. The king came back to us. That's Amfortas, the wounded Grail king. The king came back to us so pale, and all his strength gone from him. This is the death of true manhood. And a doctor's hand delved into the wound until he found the spearhead, the source of the wounding of humanity and of the emasculation of manhood. Witnessing this, the company of the Grail, those who are capable of directly and deliberately accessing the organic light, ask this question: who is to be the protector of the Grail's mysteries? Then bright eyes wept. And on that note, I'll conclude this spoken part of newsletter number 1, Constructing Conscience.